Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's never had a gargoyle fall on him yet, but there's still time. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello, my fan friends. You're almost equal to last week's audience. Almost exactly the same. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Paul Chuckle from Off the Chuckle Brothers the other day. He calls it Rahalastapas. I don't know if that's going to catch on. Let me thank the people who have helped us live. We're live streaming. Hello, live stream people. Hope you're enjoying the show. You can still buy those live streams if you go to gfsboxoffice.com. It's the only way to watch the videos if you want to see what's going on. The people who we have to thank this week are Hugh Lind Evans. He says he would like whatever Richard would like to say. For continuity, happy for one of his glorious Welsh accents to be used in full effect. Okay, Hugh, it's good to see you. Hello. Oh, boy. Boyo. You can laugh in London, that's how they talk in Wales, so it's very patronising. Very patronising to our Welsh listeners. Sorry that they laughed at you Welsh listeners. Dink Taylor is was another... Dink? Dink Taylor. What the terrible fans I've got. It says, my name appears twice in error during the Kickstarter credits on the O3G 50 DVD, so could he say my name twice or else it will play havoc on my OCD? Cheers. No. Fraser, I'd like to thank Fraser as well. He's got nothing to say, not even his surname. And I'd like to thank Dink Taylor as well for... he also gave some money. Look, if you are so inclined here in the studio, we have... copies of a program sponsored by Bulb Energy, which are of Rahalastapa. It's what broke them. Cost a lot to produce that program. And we make a collection for Scope after the show. There's buckets on the bar. If you would like to give a donation, don't feel you have to, but take a program anyway. But all the money will go to Scope, which is a fantastic charity. What I've been up to this week, I went to see the Frozen musical. Yesterday, a bit childish, I thought. A bit childish.
just watch the film, I would say. It cost, it was seven people went, it cost nearly £1,000. I'd go to a massage parlour and just get wanked off a lot instead. Probably not with your kids, though. Don't take your kids. My kids, I've been reading at night time. I've been reading, as I mentioned the other week, I've been reading a book about looking after insects with my daughter. It's huge. I'm on to moths and butterflies, which I talked about with Jos Norris. He told me that caterpillars melt in the chrysalis and then are reformed, but have the memories. The butterfly will have the memories of the caterpillar. I don't know how they test that, but that's what he claimed. I haven't found that in the book, but I found that a lot of moths and butterflies, when they emerge, don't have working mouths and are thus unable to feed, and they just live a week or two and die, presumably of starvation. What kind of a psychotic god would create? That's a terrible... We're going to just put a mouth on there, let them live for a little bit. I mean, they're going to probably get their wings pulled off by a child or eaten by a bird, but give them a chance to live. They're so beautiful. Why do that? You psychotic god. I don't pretend you don't listen to the podcast, God. I know you listen obsessively and write remarks on the YouTube videos. I know that's you. And my son continues to his attempts to be a comedian. He sometimes... leave school early and go swimming, and then I take him to pick up his sister, and he's wearing like a unicorn onesie, right, which is a bold thing to wear at school in itself. And as we are walking through the playground after picking up his sister, he started unzipping the unicorn onesie. Said, "Don't do that, Ernie." And then he pulled down his unicorn onesie, so he's walking with a unicorn onesie around his ankles in just his pants. Everyone was laughing at him. He was getting good laughs. The kids, like, it's 5 and 6 years old, and they're going, "Who is that kid?" They were kind of quite impressed. They were laughing, but they were quite impressed with his audacity. And I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "I just want to be funny like you." Now, look, he hasn't seen any of my stuff, right? So he doesn't know what kind of sophisticated comedy I do. He got lucky. That is the kind of stuff I would do. There's no way he could know that. Little prick. So he'll be a guest in 10 years' time, probably. Anything else I've got to tell you? That'll do. That'll do. Thank you very much to everyone who supported the Kickstarter. Thank you for everyone who continues to support the show. Do come and see the shows if you can. Yeah, thank you to the lovely people who've turned up tonight. And you've done the right thing. I mean, last week we had Paul Chuckle on. I mean, who could follow Paul Chuckle? That's the question. I thought long and hard. This is the greatest double bill that you have ever seen anywhere. I was hoping they would meet in the dressing room and sort of form a new Chuckle Brothers together. And my next guest is probably best known for writing an article on the iconography of the Armamian on the Ezra page of the Codex Amiatinus. That's why we're all here tonight. Can't even say it. Will you please welcome the amazing Dr. Nina Ramirez, ladies and gentlemen. Here she is from the iconography. Hello. Of the Armarium.
Do you know, it's one of my big achievements.
Yeah, it is.
So
it.
You failed in your introduction there to list one of my minor achievements.
I'm not sure it's what you're best known for. But I know you're multi-talented and study many. So you started off studying English literature and then have done... history of art.
Yeah, well, we can have
history.
The same conversation about you, because you started off studying history, and now look at the heady heights.
Amazing.
Of stand-up. Yeah, I was laughing around the side there listening to you.
I'm glad someone was.
I was listening to you describing your son, because bizarrely, my daughter has decided the only thing she wants to do in life is be a stand-up comedian.
Wow.
Which is also interesting, because it is my secret unfulfilled.
Wow.
Never
too late. It's never
too
late.
I think it is. It is. And I'll tell you why I think it is. I was doing my PhD in York, and I was having a really hard time. It's quite a lonely and weird thing to do, to spend 4 years writing a thing where you've got nobody else cares about it at all. And you're the only person that cares. And once in a blue moon, I'd go and sit in a room with an actual human. And I remember going in, and my supervisor said to me, "So Nina, you know, you're writing this thesis. It's really fantastic. It's quite obscure. I'm not sure it's going to lead to work instantly. If work doesn't happen, what are you going to do?" And I was all teary, and I was like, "I don't know. But I think my lifelong dream was always to be a stand-up comedian." She looked at me and she went, you're not funny. And I was like, oh, double bubble. So the fact my daughter wants to kind of do it, I'm like 100% behind it.
You have to deal with that if you are a stand-up comedian. You have to deal with people telling you you're not
you're
funny.
Not funny.
It doesn't ever end. So you just have to ignore
that's
them
the
and carry on. As an historian, how is it now that history is about to end? Are you happy about that? It's finished.
It's a good time.
It's over.
It's a good time to be a historian.
Yeah.
I was just saying this to the taxi driver today. I was like, you know, it's... I have just, I must say, and I was saying, I know this is a funny podcast and I will be funny, but I have just come from quite a serious event, which was I'm Polish and I was with kind of cultural representatives of Lithuania and Estonia and Czechoslovakia and Poland at an event where we had Ukrainian colleagues talking about what their families are going through. And I've had a little cry this evening. It's been a really hard thing to sit through. So... on the one hand, I have family across the border and they are getting regular hourly updates from my family saying who's made it across, who hasn't. And it's very real and it's very personal. And then there's the historian in me that always thinks back hundreds of years and forwards hundreds of years and tries to see the outcomes of things. And what I'm really heartened by is the absolute outflowing of kindness that I'm seeing. And what I really hope this is showing is people have a voice now and people don't want war. Mm-hmm. And that is my takeaway message. And every time I turn on the TV, I'm seeing the worst of humanity and then I'm seeing the best of humanity. So just, we're here to have a lovely evening out, but things are happening and they are big and they are, you know, important things.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, we can look back at history and it won't make us feel very confident about learning.
Yeah,
but things can change. I mean, it's sort of weird that, well, you know, you always think that about, how do the leaders manage to persuade the people to go and do this awful thing for them that they're usually not putting themselves at risk?
Well, that's what I think is the shifting point, actually, yeah. Richard, because I think that you could do that before the digital revolution. You could absolutely do propaganda and it would work. And that's an awful lot of what I work on is, you know, propaganda of regimes. But what's happened with social media is that I actually feel maybe not a popular opinion, but I feel sorry for the Russian people and they're going to be squeezed and things are going to be awful. And what we're seeing is that they're protesting too. They're having a really hard time and having an open platform where there still are lines of communication open. I'm getting regular updates from all over the world with people telling me what's happening. So maybe that's the key change. Maybe that's the difference.
Yeah. My worry, it's a lighthearted podcast. I'm just
going to ruin
the rest of your lives for you. My feeling is like, you know, people always said nuclear weapons were a deterrent, but this is showing that they aren't, that so people are prepared to possibly use them tactically. But also, if someone who's mental is in charge of a country, which has happened about 80% of the time in the last 5 years, is in a war that they're losing, Donald Trump's losing a world war. He's not going to go, I give up, is he?
Or Putin. I should use that. No, exactly. That was the scary kind of upscaling of it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I don't know. This will go out in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And the world may be
a nuclear wasteland.
I mean, yes.
It's going to really affect my
speaking to you in bunkers.
Yeah, it'll fuck up my downloads. Or maybe, you know, if everyone's underground, what
we're
going to do?
Let's
listen to some podcasts. Let's hear what the people of 3 weeks ago thought was going to happen.
Listen to that stupid historian, their optimism, yeah.
But, you know, it would be nice for history to be completed, is what I'm saying. And then it's nothing else to learn, is it? There's no new stuff. You know, it's then we go, history, this is it. Bourbon, we've probably got to find out a bit more about stuff that you're interested in from a long time ago.
You really think you're a historian? Come on. I mean, what is so exciting about working on the past at the moment is that the floodgates have opened, that it's not just... I mean, tonight, I hope you're admiring my beautiful dress, which has an Anne Boleyn neckline. And I did my in to history.
That's what I was thinking. I was enjoying the Anne Boleyn neckline.
First thing you were thinking, the Anne Boleyn neckline.
Look at that Anne Boleyn neckline.
My first
Isn't an Anne Boleyn neckline someone with no head, though, isn't that...
That's that's a few weeks time.
Okay.
I got in through trying to find, I suppose, the only women that we were ever taught about at school that were interesting, which was Henry VIII's wives.
Yeah.
And I remember being fascinated by them and then going back and back and finding all these other fascinating cultures and contexts. And now what is so brilliant is the lines have been a bit redrawn. We're not necessarily bothered about military leaders or warriors or kings or queens, although they still take up an awful lot of our brain space.
Sure.
We're looking for everyone else.
Yeah.
And that is amazing. And so now it's more exciting than ever to be studying it because...
But how do you find... So is this what your new book, which is not yet out, so I haven't yet read it till, called Femina?
Femina, yes.
Is this about women in...
Yeah,
Anglo-Saxon. But how do you find out about because like Anglo-Saxon and medieval times, it's very hard to find out anything apart from, you know, saints and kings.
So everybody says.
So how have you found out?
Well, because there's been enormous developments. So just digitising things, getting archives online. How many of you in here have looked up your genealogy or done any sort of family history? Somebody's, yeah, there's a couple, few hands going up. And we can do it in a way we couldn't do it before. We've got DNA analysis. We've got archaeology that doesn't even, you don't even need to pick up a trowel. You can go up in a spaceship and satellite and look down and find archaeological sites. So the technological developments are so huge, and yet our way of writing them up, our historical kind of narrative, hasn't caught up. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to say, you know, we've actually discovered so much. We've discovered cities that we didn't know about. We've discovered, you know, individual bones that lead us back to one woman that lived in Sweden in this particular period. And so it's just a redrawing of the frame. It's saying, I'm not just looking at women. I'm looking at history in a different way.
Yeah.
But I'm putting the frame around the women to find everybody else.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of idea, really.
And who have you found? Is it like actual people or just... Yeah.
I have found actual people, okay. Actual humans.
Who's the best one you found?
Oh, the best. Well, the best actually has never been completely lost. She has kind of been treasured, particularly in Germany, where she was from. So she is Leonardo da Vinci, pumped up a couple of centuries before Leonardo da Vinci. Her name is Hildegard of Bingham. Has anyone heard of Hildegard of Bingham? Nope. Please go back and read about Hildegard of Bingham. Oh, was that a yes? Yeah. She is awesome, isn't she? Look, you see,
you can't just say yes. You
He's
have
agreeing.
To tell me all about her now.
Yeah.
No clues.
I want a mini
You're
essay
going to come up here and tell...
delivered. No, Hildegard's incredible. So
yeah.
She didn't do much up until about the age of 40, which is giving me great hope. And she sort of was in a monastery and she was minding her own business, learning everything she could learn. And then it was a bit like now. There was this cataclysmic environment where the church was falling apart, where politicians were destroying each other and everyone was at war. And she became this person known as the Sibyl of the Rhine, which is such a cool name, Sibyl of the Rhine. And she grew into this polymath that could do anything. So she wrote music that's unlike any other music of the time. She was an artist. So the front cover of the book is an image she drew of a female's genitalia, which is 1,000 years old. With all the spots marked as well, just for kind of handy guidance.
Are they still the same place?
They're in the same place. Okay. It's funny, we haven't evolved
okay.
to the point where they've moved. and then she was a scientist, she wrote natural history tracts, and she just extraordinary, and she lived to the age of 80. And because of that, she had this like 40 years of output. And you know, she lived 1,000 years ago, and you kind of find her and you go, wow, women have been awesome forever. And we're, you know, maybe we should redraw our understanding of that.
Yeah, the medieval period and Anglo-Saxon periods, which are of particular interest to you, I think, are the ones that I'm the weakest on. I have been trying to catch up over the last year or two. You did a book about the lives of the saints and their true lives, but they're sort of the only Anglo-Saxon lives we've got really good ideas about, right?
Texts are a pain when you get into that period, but archaeology is brilliant.
Right.
So you put it all together. You're like a detective. You're kind of piecing bits together. So I use all the disciplines. You know, I'm kind of like a kid in a sweet shop going, well, I'll use a bit of DNA analysis and a little bit of art history and mix in a bit of literature. And only that way, I mean, it would be the same as trying to tell the story of what's happening now from just the accounts that are written up in chronicles and histories. To understand how the world we live in, you need to make it sensory. You need to fill it with all the things we fill our lives with. We fill our lives with music and art and visuals. And so how would you look at the past any differently? Why would you go in from just one angle?
Sure.
You know?
But that's the, you know, that was, those were, I mean, it's weird that only, you know, religious people would document. And I suppose partly it survived because churches sometimes survived, often didn't. But, you know, so that they were the only people writing stuff down.
Yeah.
But so was the Anglo-Saxon time, well, there obviously was a sort of, when the Romans left the Britain, there was a period of at least disquiet and economic problems.
Yeah.
But was it as bad as...
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, what we could be moving towards. It was pretty apocalyptic,
yeah.
I think. So I went on holiday over half term with my kids to... I won't tell you the secret because it's my secret hotel that's so awesome that no one else can go to. But it's a really, really amazing family place just over the Severn Bridge. And it's right near to this town called Caerleon. I know I'm saying that wrong. Caerleon?
Yeah.
You're very good at Welsh.
I'm very good at Caerleon. Caerleon.
Caerleon.
How do you say it?
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you for that. I had never heard of it as a historian working in this place. It's this incredible, it's the most Western fortress that the Romans built, right? And it's in, you can go and you can see the actual baths that they swam in. And it's just this idea that there was this sort of industrial-sized machine of the Roman Empire just rolling out its IKEA flat pack, this is Rome version, right the way up to the edges of Wales. But I found that really interesting because it kind of disappears in the fourth century, and you just think, yeah, that is cataclysmic. That is change on a huge level. How do we measure the impacts of disasters? How do we measure the impacts of change? Language, you know, destruction to the landscape, destruction to art and architecture. They are sort of indicators, and often that's the saddest part of my job is when I can see that, when I can actually see when civilizations, groups of people have been wiped out. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah.
I stood on a shoreline in Crete. I was doing this thing on the Palace of Knossos, and this brilliant, charismatic Canadian archaeologist took me down onto the beach, and he went, look behind you. And I said, well, you know, this is just, why are you digging here? There's nothing here. He said, look, and there's this ridge, which you never would have thought anything about when you walk along beaches. And he started picking at it with his fingertips, and he was pulling out Minoan pottery that was, you know, 4,000 years old. He's going, that's Minoan. And everything, the whole sediment in this bank of sand was Minoan archaeology. And what had happened was there'd been a tsunami that had hit the island around the year 1400 and smashed up all of the towns on that side of Crete and then washed all the debris down to this beach. And it was just there. Yeah. And I was just standing there going, wow, I'm on the site of a disaster. But my God, look, you know, there's like 4,000-year-old pottery here. It was weird.
Yeah.
So, being a historian is a weird thing, really, because you're constantly looking forward and seeing the potential for humanity to do things differently. But you're also constantly looking backwards and seeing, you know, the things that have hurt us.
Are the things that leave the moat. The thing where things are destroyed... Or, you know, like, I mean, Pompeii's an obvious example where something cataclysmically horrible has happened. That's where you get your bet. So it gives you an almost false idea because you don't get much from you don't get much of the good times, but you get lots of the bad times.
Lots of bad times. So although I do like Pompeii. When I was there with my kids, I said, it's a bit like Blackpool, you know? If you wanted to kind of go to Roman Blackpool, it was a good time town. It was a seaside resort. Yeah. And it's the tragedy mixed with the fact it's preserved. The fact that they've left a mark on time, which is a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm getting very heavy,
It's all right. That's why we're here. You know, it's just... Yeah, someone had to follow Paul Chuckles, and I thought the best way to do that was about the destruction.
Going about death and destruction, that's the way annihilate a chuckle.
This is what history is. Well, let's quickly talk. This is, there's some destruction in this, but a lovely book. This is that's just come out called Goddess. It's about 50. I wish all history books were like this.
I know, it's so pretty.
I guess, A, it's beautiful, and B, it's just two pages on each subject that summarise it very nicely. I'm guessing it's for young people.
It is.
But I love it.
But my God, the amount of work I put into that.
Yeah, I can
my
tell.
My God. So I remember getting this email that said, oh, Nina, you know, the British Museum are going to be putting on this exhibition about goddesses. It's the first one of its kind, international approach. It's going to be amazing. And we want to do a book for children. Will you write it? And I know it's going to be called 50 Goddesses from Around the World. I was like, yeah, you know, I'll look them up on Wikipedia. It'll be fine. Take me a bit of time, 2 pages each. Anyway, after I'd written the first few, I realised I was working with a team of about 60 curators who are the international experts on every single aspect of every single thing I've said. So then I realised, oh my God, I've got to research everything. So I suddenly had to research all world religions from all cultures across all of time and write about each of them. So I crammed. Luckily, I shouldn't say luckily, there was a kind of opportunity to stay at home and write a lot called a pandemic, which meant that I did get my head in the game and read a lot. But it opened my world. It opened my mind up to the world in a way I've never really done. You studied history. When you do English history, it's so small, it's so narrow. And then I'm reading about, you know, Hindu goddesses that go back thousands of years and about Aztec divinities and African spirits. And it's just, it was the most eye-opening thing I've done.
I think it's when you start looking at how many gods there have been throughout history. And actually, when you start studying it as well, it's kind of, I'm just listening to Francesca Stavropoulou's book about God and Anatomy. And what I didn't realize, I think I've studied the Bible, maybe it's the New Testament more, but I've read a lot about biblical studies, and I didn't realize that our God, Yahweh, you know him?
You know him?
He has a dad.
Yeah.
And he's got 69 brothers. And so I had never heard of that. So El or Ael is this where Israel and is in all of the names of everything. He was he's the God's dad.
Yep.
And he was the main God for a bit, and then Yahweh came in and sort of knocked him off his perch. That tribe was that had Yahweh became a bit bigger and successful, and so that God became successful. So it's sort of crazy that people are, you know, that are religious don't go back and go, well, should I go back right to the beginning and find out where this came from?
I mean, I do a session with my students where I try, because, you know, if you're going to look at medieval stuff, you've kind of got to understand where Christianity come from.
Yeah.
To understand where Christianity's come from, you've got to look at earlier religions. And I kind of blow their brains on the first week because I just sort of show them all this wonderful word. If you take nothing away from this evening, I give you the gift of this word. The word is syncretism. It's a lovely word. And it means two disparate things blending into something new. And I tell them, you know, you've got Apollo, you've got Mithras, you've got the goddess Isis, you've got all these cults, all these figures that are about, and you've got Judaism, and you've got different sort of monotheistic thrusts happening. And then Christianity sort of builds its own unique selling points on the basis of everything that's around it.
Yeah.
But it only grows over time, and it's looking at these things as evolving, you know. History is never a line in the sand. It's never a moment where one thing ends and another begins necessarily. It's more often a kind of organic change, you know. Religions are like that too. It's fascinating.
I know, but you sort of, you know, you sort of think, well, A, having studied all those religions, did you know, was there anything that connected all of those 500,
oh my God,
those 50 goddesses?
Everything connects all of them. Because the ultimate thrust in all of them are the basic human needs and desires.
Yeah.
Every single one of them resonated because every single one of them is tying into a desire we have, a need we have. So many of them are connected with the earth, with animals, you know, with fertility, because that's basic existence, isn't it? And then war and destruction, you know, that's in there. And then love and empathy and kindness and knowledge, all these really basic core human beliefs, they're shared across the whole world and across time.
Sure.
And so that was kind of enlightening to see that.
Yeah. And there's a need to try and, I mean, it's a primeval way of explaining where the universe has come from and explaining, you know, and it's very hard to imagine living in a time where things are that confusing and that scary that you go, if I do this thing, then hopefully this will happen. We'll get food, we'll get sunshine, whatever. So you start to believe, you know, each action will lead to something, and that's how... But I mean, a lot of the things are so imaginatively crazy.
Yeah.
You know, of...
Well,
combination, I mean, of animals.
Are we any more crazy today, Richard? I have these moments, these glimmers, where I sort of look at humanity today, and I just sort of think, you know, we put value on a Bitcoin, and we say it means something, and we say it will have value in time to come.
Yeah.
When it is a concept that we've invented, just like cash, just like money. Yeah. Like all these things, you know, we invent our own fantasies and then fulfill them and make them real. And a lot of these people, you know, that they're creating hybrid creatures, they're creating a fantastical world, but we're still creating all sorts of weird nonsense that we subscribe to.
Of course, yeah. I mean, everything is sort of insane. But is it because of, I don't know, because they feel like it's sort of drug-induced,
yeah,
you know, drip nightmares.
I like that.
And is that where they came from?
Yeah, no, I do like that. Yeah, lots of drugs were imbued in some of these environments. I read some amazing ritual accounts that just blew my brains and, yeah, put everything from the 60s to shame, really. People were doing it a lot better 1,000 years ago. I have another thing, which is about manuscript illumination. So I get really excited when I look at, like, the psychedelic stuff you see in Hildegard, but also the Book of Kells. Any Kells fans out there? I'm looking to my Hildegard buddy down here. Lindisfarne Gospels. These weird, overlapping, exploding images that just, they're so colourful, they're so weird, you don't know where to look. And I always describe them a bit like, you know those magic eye things, mm-hmm, where a dolphin's supposed to jump out at you? I remember being a kid in the 80s and everyone I knew could do them. And I would sit there for like 5-6 hours kind of crossing my eyes. I never saw a sodding dolphin. But they were, this is an interesting thing, because they were using lead-based ink. They were licking the quill.
All right.
At the end. And lead is it builds up in the brain.
Yeah.
And it causes a sort of degenerative hallucinations. So I genuinely think they were probably really quite high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's an argument there was like psychedelic drugs in the wheat, amongst the wheat fields of, you know, around biblical times in biblical places. Mm. So, you know, they were getting that ground into their bread and not realising. Mm. Makes sort of sense, but also, you know, I don't, it is sort of fascinating. I think if you were going to base your whole life on believing something. I mean, that's where a book like this, you sort of, and it's good for young people as well, to show this is the vast range. Here's just 50 gods.
All these choices, yeah.
That could have been the gods.
Yeah.
But, you know, why, you know, it's sort of interesting that people would take, well, I'm going to just take what I've been told. I'm not going to go back and see how that developed or what people said just before this, the people got together and decided this was the Bible or this was the Bible. So there's all these extra books, there's all these extra gods, and you can find it out through archaeology and through history, and you can find out what,
yeah,
what I was mean, actually going I mean, on.
Now when I think back to whether I should have been a stand-up or a historian, yeah. my major pleasure about being a historian is that there are so many half-truths and actual outright lies in circulation that it takes a tiny bit of research, a tiny bit of scratching the surface of something to see it for what it is. And yet they're so widely distributed, they're so endemic, they're so built in that they're believed and then they form the future. You know, mm-hmm, they inform how we see ourselves in the past and they inform where we're going in the future. And so, you know, this is one way of doing it. This is a way of saying, look at the world, look at the variety, look at the choices, look at the, you know, the culture, the geography, the climates, look how all these things interact when it comes to belief and culture. But there's also the way that I'm also taking in the other book, which is to myth bust. It's just to go right back and go, no, this has been written by us by, frankly, arseholes from the past. You know, that's my take on it. You know, we've had our past manipulated for us.
Yeah.
And that's why it's kind of exciting to be doing this right now.
Sure.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify.
Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Well, I'm very jealous of you. I mean, I think I made the right choice in not becoming an historian and becoming a stand-up comedian.
I was going to ask.
I think so. But, I mean, what I'm jealous about you, and especially in the TV work you've been doing, is you get to, you know, you're absolutely hands-on with all of these amazing artifacts and the fantastic TV shows. I was watching the Raiders of the Lost Past.
Yes, say Ark.
Yeah, I feel like Mark Watson came up with that title for that show. But but it's a fantastic show. I saw it a few months ago actually, but it stayed. But I'm very obsessed with Sutton Hoo. So for you to go and to the British Museum and be handling all of the stuff. Practically ripping the mask off and putting it on, not quite.
Oh no! Well, I did put the false one
yeah.
on. I couldn't help it. I'm not surprised. I still can't believe I did it myself. But I could take this right back to when I was how old was I? 21. Yeah. So I was doing my masters, and I'd chosen to do this obscure kind of early medieval masters. And I remember we were way up in York, and our tutor came in one day and went, "Hey, we're going on a field trip to London. Yay. So we're going to go in the minibus." And there was about 8 of us, all nut jobs who are into this early medieval stuff. And we thought, right, we're going to the British Museum. Fantastic. And they'd got the curator. I mean, I'm not going to name names because this is quite kind of incriminating. But I thought we were going to sit in this room and she was going to get out sort of some old rusty nails and maybe a sort of crap old buckle or something. Anyway, we sat down in the dark, and there's just one spotlight in the middle, and she walks in with the Sutton Hoo buckle and the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasp on a cushion.
Okay.
Right? And there's 8 around a table. She comes in, she puts it up to the person next to me, and it's going away from me around the circle, and I'm starting to hyperventilate. It's like the single most exciting thing. I don't know, for those of you who don't know these objects, so the Sutton Hoo buckle is about a kilogram of solid gold, carved with snakes and serpents, and the shoulder clasps are possibly even more beautiful. There's 2 of them, and they're gold and garnet cloisonné. And the garnet cells are like down to points of a millimeter, and they're all presented with these back plates that sparkle. They are the I spoke to Gareth's jewelers when I was making the program first time around, who are the Royal Jewelers, and they said they would need a month. Running water, constant electricity, and £200,000 worth of natural resources to make one now. And they made 2 of these in the year 620. Crazy. Yeah. So my students often say, it was the aliens. It's not the aliens. It's just very skilled craftspeople. But anyway, so this thing was coming around on this cushion, and we all had our gloves on, and each student was allowed to sort of just turn them on the cushion, just have a little look. And it got closer and closer, and I'm thinking, I feel faint, I feel weird, I don't feel good right now. And then they passed the cushion to me, and I fainted. Oh, and I dropped the cushion, and it fell. And everyone, it was like, beep, beep, beep. I went into kind of disaster mode within the British Museum, and they whizzed these things off. And surprisingly, they've never let people handle them since.
But then I got to go back
and do it again.
That's not fair. You ruined it for everyone else. Do you see, when you see these things like and handle them and that close, do you see new things in them that you
every single time? So, you know, I often say to this to people, you know, when you find the thing that really gets you going, really turns you on like nothing else, try and make it your job. And that could be anything. And I'm not going down that route, but it could be, you know, I try and understand why people are fascinated by stamps. I try and understand why people love soil or birds or grass samples. I try and understand it because they're passionate about it for a reason. Well, my thing are these ancient objects, and I just can't get enough of them. I can't describe to you how awesome it feels to hold like a 40,000-year-old piece of mirror in your hand and look into it and see your face reflected back when you know that someone 40,000 years ago looked in it and saw their face reflected back. You know, those sorts of things, I can't fake that. That is genuine, like, oh, I'm losing it when I'm holding these things. Yeah. And I think the BBC were just, they just noticed that I happen to be a complete nutshell when it comes to old objects. And so, oh, stick a camera on her, you know, watch her do it in real time.
Well, you're very enthusiastic.
So
you're very, which is a great attribute. I mean, I was going to ask you about how, you know, how that journey came to the TV. But you also, we're talking to Paul Shuckle about the moustache and the hair he has.
I haven't got a moustache.
You haven't got a moustache, but maybe if you put the moustache in, you could be a success.
Lift it, yeah, it could lift the whole look.
But you have a look.
Thank you.
You know, then it's a very interesting. And I wondered if it was if that was a decision you made. I'm going to go on TV.
Oh my God, was this just you? Oh no, I get laughed at by actual goths because I'm not an actual goth. I don't like goth music. Sorry, goths, but I have got. I've only worn black since I was sort of 13, 14, really. I went through a bit of a colourful stage where I was into hip-hop and I started wearing kind of quite bright things. And then I quite quickly realised that black is, you know, black clothes just, they look great all the time. You never look bad. She says, wearing what is not, obviously not a black dress tonight. This was just for you, Richard.
Thank you.
But no, I mean, it was really funny because I never, ever meant to do TV. I was... you know, struggling academic. I was pregnant and I was working part-time and I knew I didn't have a full-time contract, so I wasn't going to get any maternity pay. And I remember running at like 8 months pregnant, could barely stand up, running between lectures at Warwick University to kind of jump up in front of an audience and do an hour's lecture and then run off to the other side. And things were really hard. And I got back from that gig and my son was born, and it was his actual christening day. We had, and I've got a massive family, Polish, Irish, Scottish, Spanish. And they were all at this party. And the phone goes, and I've got my little baby in my arm, and I say, please hold the baby. Run off, answer the phone. And I hear this voice, and I'm like, hello, this is the BBC.
This is the BBC.
It was that. It was, oh, it's Doctor Who. It's, you know, everything I've ever watched. And it was just actually a sort of 20-year-old researcher, you know, in an office somewhere. And he said, we're going to make this series on the Normans, but we've never done on television what came before that. So I typed into Google Anglo-Saxon art. The person who came up first was out of the country, so I phoned you. Wow. Anyway, 2.5 hours later,
yeah,
all the guests have gone. And I'm still on the phone to this guy going, and another thing, have you ever seen this? So it was all from a phone call. And then they said, well, you're obviously really passionate about it. We'll come up and meet you. You can tell us a bit more about it. So I thought, this is probably my only brush with celebrity. I'm going to make them buy me a cocktail at the Randolph Hotel. He knows. Posh cocktails. So I said, I'll meet you at the Randolph and then I'll take you to the Ashmolean and I'll show you some stuff. And they brought this camera along and I was thinking, oh, it's like a dictaphone. They're just sort of listening, writing some notes, whatever. And I walked around and I was doing all this and I was looking at all the art and I was poking in all the cabinets. And the camera kept sort of creeping up, creeping down. And at the end, the guy went, thank you so much. That was so useful. We'll get in touch if anything comes of it. But there's, you know, 200 programs all in the running. It might not ever happen. Just before Christmas, I get this phone call and they say, yeah, they've commissioned it. And not only that, they want you to present it. I wouldn't even know where to start. And in my mind, I was like, brilliant, I can retire. I'll have a Winnebago with a powder puff woman who'll come out and do my face. I'll just live on champagne. And then they told me the fee, which was basically I had to pay for my own transport. So by the time I'd done that, I came home with nothing. but I wanted to make it because I was passionate. So I had to learn on the job. And I basically spent the last 12 years learning on the job. And I'm really lucky. And I love what I do. Sure. And I, you know, I'm really grateful for
just
all
think
of it.
If that first person on the Google search had been in the country.
Well, she was my supervisor. Oh, really? And she was in Australia visiting her son, which I knew about. Okay. But the guy who found me was a guy called Ted, and I still like text him regularly and go, thanks for finding me. Thank you. It's all down to you.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's very engaging, and you know, I love that. That's Sutton Hoo-Wall especially. The thing I liked best out of it, which I wasn't aware of, was the been grave robbers obviously robbing a lot of
Wasn't that awesome with the gin bottle at the bottom of the shaft, because they've kind of given up, got drunk and gone home.
Yeah.
I love
so
that.
Because the end of the barrow had been cut off by a plough, they thought the middle was in a different place than it was. So they dug down and were just a few feet away from finding...
Inches. They were so close to the chamber. And they'd have found all that gold, all that treasure. But you're right, they'd miscalculated because of the weathering.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because we literally found these sort of 18th century gin bottle shards.
Yeah.
Where they'd obviously just thought, there's no point carrying on. We're not going to find anything.
I love the fact they were drinking gin as they were trying to steal artifacts.
Make it fun. But it's a weird place if you visit it.
Yeah.
It's got an atmosphere, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was up there on the mound and I was doing an interview, and this cat just appears out of nowhere, this grey cat just sort of wanders up on the mound, and I'm looking around, and you know there's nothing around there at all. And he's there, and he's rubbing himself around my legs, and he was refusing to leave the shot while we were filming. He just kept stuck to me like glue. And then he vanished, and so I went back to the entrance, and I said, so there was this cat up there, and they said, yeah, he comes every kind of few weeks. We see him, we call him Radwald, named after potentially the king that was buried there, and we don't know where he lives, we don't know what he's got to do with the place, but he appears and then he disappears. And I was like, and this cat is gorgeous. I'm a big cat lover.
Okay,
you're a dog person, aren't you?
I've got a dog and a cat.
Oh,
I prefer the dog. I could do without the cat.
Come on. That's it. You are less sophisticated, clearly.
My dog's great. that's sort of like a ghost. Can you tell anything? Do you think it's Radwalders? Do you think that is who's in there? Can you tell anything from history? Can you tell from the Sutton Hoo burial whether the King Radwald ever tried to suck his own cock? Can you tell that?
No.
So you still can't tell everything.
Funnily enough, no. I mean, if we had some bones, we might have to see if he'd sort of done any major limbo exercises or no.
Could have had a bit.
But sadly not, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, that's until history can do that.
I have seen there's a really interesting grave in Repton where the guy has been castrated. He's a Viking warrior.
Okay.
And he's had it cut off. And you can see it's like they've gone in, like there's like slash marks either side. And then when they've gone to bury him, they're obviously feeling a bit sorry for him that he's emasculated. So they stuck a great big boar's tusk between his legs to kind of compensate.
Yeah.
And so in that case, I think you can maybe say a bit more, but I don't know if he could suck his own, no.
Yeah. Sorry. Sometimes they bury them up, don't they? They cut it off and stick it in their mouth.
There are some weird ones with them in the mouth, and then in like 69 positions and all sorts of strange graves like that. Yeah.
I knew we'd get on some good stuff if we did that.
Hang around long enough. That's
the sex. Well, I've got another history-based emergency question that has flummoxed most people, but I think you'll be able to answer this one, and I don't know enough about it to be able to answer it. Would you rather be Stephen King or King Stephen?
Oh, see? That's a cracking... Did you write that?
I did, but no one knows enough about King Stephen.
Enormous high five to you for the most perfect question.
Thank you.
It's
good for you.
Not King Stephen at all. Stephen King, I mean, for all reasons. King Stephen, no way. Matilda every time. I mean, God, rubbish. But Stephen King, I'm a huge horror fan.
Okay.
I'm a massive horror junkie. So for all my kind of seeming academic credentials, when I curl up in bed with my four cats, I stick on a bit of horror and a bit of Stephen King, and he's like my kind of idol, so...
King Stephen, though, right? If it wasn't for the White Ship going down... This is all I know. I read a book about the White Ship.
The Kevin Smith plays himself.
It's like sliding doors. I want to do a sliding doors film.
but it's
where he didn't go down on the white ship.
Well,
yeah.
he had diarrhea, didn't he? He didn't go on the white ship.
Well, you'd be amazed how much of history has been determined by people having diarrhoea. Yeah. So much of it.
The white ship sank and everyone, all the nobles of a whole generation died, apart from King Stephen, who was having a shit.
Yeah, yeah. And so it goes on. But no, but then that was when shit saves you, because the other thing is when people get like massive kind of dysentery and diarrhoea
yeah.
and then they die. I mean, Æthelflæd, I've been writing about Æthelflæd, the Lady of the Mercians, and she's one of my absolute superstars. She was Alfred the Great's daughter, and all of her history was rewritten to kind of wipe her out of it. But she was possibly better than her dad at military strategy and at kind of economic strategy and politics. And she was at the point of reunifying all of the kingdoms of England with Scotland and with Wales for the first time. This is in like the 9th century. And she got sick and died. And we don't know how she died. I mean, some say, could it be poison? Could she have just been topped off? But she was on the brink of it, on the eve of going to York and getting all of their fealty. Yeah. So how different history would be without whatever happened to her.
I mean, it's true of any point in history, isn't it, though?
Isn't it, Jess?
If you change anything in history, it's all different, isn't it?
I like the depth of that as a concept.
That's my problem with the film Sliding
Butterfly
Doors.
Butterfly effect.
You just change anything and everything changes. My problem with Sliding Doors is not enough changes.
Not enough changes.
Not enough changes.
Change the change. Change everything the initial changes. Change.
If you decided not to come on this podcast, imagine how different your life would have been.
I know. I'm sure it'd be transformed.
It will be absolutely transformed. Yeah. You won't believe
it. I won't
you,
know myself.
If you think that phone call from the BBC was good, you wait for this.
Yeah, waiting for that Winnebago and powder puff.
I don't think I saw this one in the Raiders of the Lost Past. I think I saw a bit from the first series and a bit from the second series.
Because
I was watching on BBC iPlayer and it just came in whatever order it came in. But I don't remember. You went. The Mexico trip sounds very exciting.
My gosh, that was so exciting. The most exciting thing about the Mexico trip was the build-up to the Mexico trip, because we were going into a particularly rough area. We were going down into the Gulf. So this was, two years ago probably. And with Trump and his wall, he'd kind of redrawn the whole dynamic around that area of Mexico. And what actually had happened was a lot of the trade, illegal and legal, had shunted down the Gulf.
Right.
And most people, we went into Mexico City. Mexico City is a stunning, gorgeous, beautiful, brilliant place. Very cosmopolitan, very kind of, everything's easy. And then we knew we were traveling for 8 hours down the Gulf into quite unknown areas. So we had to have a police guard, armed guard with us at all times. Curfew was 7 p.m, never be out on the roads after 7. There was all this stuff. But the best bit was that we got sent this health and safety document. Usually when I do a thing like this, it's a couple of pages. Don't climb ladders, don't stick things on your head, you know, clever. But this one was 35 pages long. And my husband was already a bit nervous. He was like, oh, you're going away to Mexico for 2 weeks, leaving us. How's it going to be? And there was 2 pages dedicated to how to escape a crocodile attack. And this is gold, honest, solid gold advice, right? How would you escape a crocodile attack? What would you do if it was coming? And they lumber, don't they? They're like that.
I'd throw my son in.
Nice.
Yeah. That he's only little.
Bit brutal.
Yeah, but, you know.
That's genuinely your first. What if you don't have a child handy?
I'd take my kids with me. I'd take both kids.
Carry emergency children.
There's two crocodiles.
The crocodile attacks.
Yeah.
No children, no resources. What do you do? It's coming at you. Come on.
I would lie down very still and pretend to be a stone.
Mm. So long to you, my friend. You needed the advice of the BBC Health and Safety booklet. So, because they move in this zigzag way, a lot of people think the best thing to do is to run away from them in a zigzag manner.
Right.
But the reality is that I think it's 300 yards. Over the first 300 yards, a crocodile is much faster than a human running at full pelt. So the idea is, if you see them start to gather up speed, you run at your literal sprint fastest in a straight line, and after 300 yards, it will stop and fall back. So if you can survive over that period of outrunning it, you're on to a winner.
Okay.
But that's not what I would have done. I probably would have taken the zigzag approach.
I definitely wouldn't have zigzagged.
No.
Why go in the same direction as the crocodile?
They're just like... like that, aren't they? So yeah. You've sort
but
of.
But they're zigzagging. Don't zigzag in. That's plain
no
into
zigzag.
Their hands.
Just super sprint. That's the yeah. answer.
Well, hippos, I just said so run away. I was going to say run. I'd run away really fast. Oh yeah, that's right. Well done.
Well then, I would have given. I would have said well done. You'd have I'd got just rewards.
I'd run away and
answer.
Then go in a big tree. Can they go up trees?
Throwing children into this mix was not the solution.
They
find a tree.
Yeah,
that would be all right. That would okay. be quite good.
So did you get attacked by a croc?
No, unfortunately, no. I wanted to try out my new sprint. Been training for weeks.
So what was in Mexico? So because it was all about sort of pre-war, this archaeological discoveries yeah. that it does fit in well with Indiana Jones, I have to
it
say.
It was an amazing concept.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of give it to Jonty Claypole from the BBC. It was his idea. But I'll credit him for now. But I wanted to make this series, which was very different from every other archaeology TV show, which was that when you watch Treasures of the Egyptians, it's sort of boom, boom, and it takes you back and it tries to reconstruct the chronology. But what's so interesting about archaeology is often the finds, how they were made, when they were made, who made them, what was their political, social environment when they made them. And we've discovered there were these three major discoveries all made on the eve of war in 1939. Sutton Hoo's the famous one. Anyone see The Dig? It was pretty good, I thought. It was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Many of my friends disagreed. I found it very sweet. With added love interest. So there was Sutton Hoo. There was the discovery of the Lion Man, which is this incredible prehistoric mammoth tusk that dates back 20,000 years. And it's incredible. It's the sort of birth of human imagination where it's half man, half lion. And then there was the Olmec heads in Mexico. And that was the funniest one. I suppose that was the most Indiana Jonesy one because it was a National Geographic exercise and they went out and they really were going into the middle of nowhere with machetes just hacking the bushes apart on local knowledge and discovering these heads that are, they're huge. They're absolutely enormous. The Olmec heads, they're solid boulders that have been carved with these really powerful facial expressions. And as a result of those discoveries, they discovered a whole new culture. So we knew about Mayans and Aztecs, but we didn't know about the Olmecs. And the Olmecs were putting up these heads at the same time as the pyramids were going up. Right. And then you think, bloody hell, and also they were building pyramids, but they were building pyramids out of mud bricks.
Yeah.
So this idea that two civilizations that had no contact with one another, one in Egypt and one in Mexico, both had the idea of making these enormous pyramids out of different materials. What's going on there?
Aliens.
It is, isn't it?
Aliens came down and said, we've travelled across the galaxy metal ships, but we're going to make you build some pyramids out of stone and mud.
There you go.
For us.
Yeah, I've just been over to Egypt. They've got it much nicer over there. They've had their drive redone.
Did you discover, I listened to you on a podcast, you discovered a head that hadn't been discovered.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's crazy.
It was so fun.
So how did you do
it? It was all so maverick filming that. I can't believe, it was just... It was a gang of kind of five of us knocking about in this beaten up van going around God knows where in Mexico. And we'd heard that this drug cartel had just abandoned a ranch in the area where we knew that they'd been quarrying for the stone to make the heads.
Right.
And so nobody had really been there. We turn up on this deserted street in the middle of the forest and there it is, the ranch, and it's a little bit burnt out. But it kind of looks like it could still have people in it. So kind of we're walking up going, is there anyone in here? And we went around the back of the ranch and it was snakes and spiders and grass up above my head. And so we're working our way through. And this guide that was with us said, I think I've seen some actual Olmec sculptures around the back of the ranch. We go around and he just pulls this grass back like this. And there is a full long sculpture, Olmec sculpture, say 4,000 years old, of this woman. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and it's just lying there in the dirt. And then he says, and I think if we go around here, this is where they quarried the heads, And what was there was a head, but it hadn't been finished. What had happened was a natural crack had come through the boulder. Right. So they'd given up on it, but they'd already carved most of it. And it's not recorded. So there are like 14 recorded and this one in the middle of nowhere. And I got to find it.
That's pretty cool.
Boom! It was so much fun! I did get a bit excited and did a happy dance. But yeah, it's really exciting. Yeah. Lots of these sort of spontaneous things happen kind of when you're working, especially on digs where they're live and they're sort of happening around you. It's, oh my God, it's just so... Yeah. I'm such a nerd, but
it's a great series. I think it's all still on iPlayer, right? I was a couple of months ago.
Nobody tells me anything.
I think it is.
I don't know.
But I don't know what I saw because I didn't see that one. I thought I was watching the same series. It might have just gone to something, a different series.
Okay, yeah, there was a second series.
But why did they show me Sutton Hoo and then... sometimes I watch things on iPlayer and they show you the last episode first. If you're watching a drama, that's...
That's brilliant, isn't it?
I thought this is a bold start. Fill in a lot of gaps here. Oh, I've watched the last episode.
Yeah. I was doing that with my daughter recently because I'm trying to educate her in kind of the best comedy that she has to see. And I mean, she's only 10, but she's seen everything. I mean, things that were really, you know, my parents wouldn't have let me see. But I was doing Absolutely Fabulous recently with her. We've been working our way through really carefully, episode by episode. And then... More forward did that to me. It showed me the last episode. We're sat there watching it and she's going, why has Safi got a baby? Why is Patsy not there? What's going on? And so, yeah, it spoils it, doesn't it, when it comes through wrongly. But I think, yeah, you need to give me some advice for her. I need to
let her watch everything. I listened to Derek and Clive when I was about 12.
So. My dad played it on vinyl to me when I was about that age. Yeah.
And I'd listen secretly. I don't think my mum and dad would have let me listen to that if they'd known what it was. But I listened to it secretly.
See, yeah. It's weird when you get your dad sat there going, isn't it funny? And there's all this sea bombs coming at me.
But I also think if you want to, you know, if she's 10 and wants to do it and is that obsessed with it, she probably is going to do it.
Yeah. She writes scripts. She sits there at night and she's coming up with ideas, and I mean, unfortunately, she's obsessed with James Acaster. Okay. Dare I mention?
Yeah, you can't have everything. He is pretty good.
Is that bad taste?
No, it's pretty good taste. If it was Ed Gamble, there'd be problems.
Oh no,
there would be big troubles. But
no, we've had conversations.
So I do ask this. I've asked this a lot, but I'm very interested to know what your answer to this question is, because also I think you could probably get away with doing this for real. But I have an emergency question. If all the museums and art galleries in the world got together and said, we love you, Nina.
Me?
Yeah.
They love me.
Yeah, we love you. We love your work. We're going to give you one thing to keep from all of the museums and art galleries in the world. What one thing would you... I mean, I think you could probably steal something from the British Museum anyway.
Well,
you'd probably
get
away with
a
cufflink or two.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you were able to be gifted something, which thing would you most like?
God.
And that's a hard question for you, especially.
Any museum and art gallery in the world?
Yeah.
Edvard Munch's Madonna.
Right. I don't know what I'm going to have to Google it.
I don't know what you're going to have to do with that. It's a beautiful... So you know Munch, Scream.
I do, that's what I know.
He painted a series of these Madonnas, and I had one next to my bed from when I was little, and... I don't know if it's the narcissist in me, but she's quite a dark-haired, pale-skinned, naked woman. But she's got this incredible red halo. And she's lifting her head up to the sky as this sort of... She's both being adored and adoring herself and looking to the future. And she's just always inspired me. It's like everything I hoped I could achieve in that one image. Mm-hmm. But you've really surprised me and caught me off guard, because my other answer would have been the Lindisfarne Gospels. So
yeah, that's pretty good.
Can I stick one in each pocket?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with you is you like art and
I
history.
I like it all. So, I want it all.
A lot of people.
And the shiny things. I like the shiny things too. I want the shiny things.
I asked Paul Chuckle backstage about what his favourite museum was, and he said he'd like museums, and he liked there was one in Rotherham that had a stuffed lion in it. So that's what he'd have gotten for.
The stuffed lion from Rotherham Museum.
The stuffed lion from Rotherham, which I think was a waste. Well, that was a waste of the
there's
wish.
There's a very nice stuffed bear in the Pitt Rivers that I wouldn't mind. Yeah. He's quite nice. But no, I mean, stuffed animals I love. But I love them anyway. I get them anyway. I'm a bit of a fan of taxidermy.
You can stuff your own animals. You don't need to get one of those from a museum.
Yeah.
Just kill a bear, stuff
I have been saying that. Well, I mean, my husband has quite quickly whipped them all off to the crematorium as soon as they die, because he has a fear that I'm going to go into amateur taxidermy and start stuffing all the bears.
It's everything about goths apart from the music.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Fantastic. Look. I wanted, you were in rock bands.
I was.
How did that go?
Ask my brothers from another mother. I mean, they're still my boys. I've been in a couple of bands.
Yeah.
My first band I joined when I was 14, and we were all girls. And in fact, I was the oldest at 14. We were called Lolita.
Okay.
I thought that sort of, I know.
Cancelled.
Fully cancelled.
I mean, that's a very
It was
clever.
A great name. Interesting, the lead singer, Christy Morrison, she was the first ever female editor of the NME.
Okay.
And she now is a music reporter. She works for the Times. But she went on to become like this huge kind of influence on the music scene, whereas I didn't. but that was my first band. I played bass in that band.
Okay.
Very badly. And then my main band were called Role Models. And I was the singer. And my worst ever experience was when we were kind of getting a bit big and I was doing work experience in a solicitor's office. And and I'd sort of mentioned to the group of solicitors that I was doing a gig that night in Reading and, you know, where it was and what time it was. And we were quite sort of punk rock. We were quite heavy. And I went on stage in a completely see-through catsuit, which was a bold move by any standards, but it was the 90s. And I went out and I was like, I'm going to rock this, I'm going to own this. And I looked down and the entire front row is every solicitor from the firm staring at me going, and I had to go into work the next day. It was all very uncomfortable. But I loved it. And I think, being in a band, I wasn't musically talented particularly. I just wanted the experience. And yeah. I wanted that sense of being in a family, doing something creative together, which is kind of what I get making documentaries. I love being a little gang out there making something.
You're definitely a performer. You know, I think you could have been a stand-up. I can't see why you wouldn't have been a stand-up. Because there's it's the enthusiasm and confidence is 90% of being a comedian.
Well, I think it's also wordplay. I'm so fascinated by what you guys do, how you write, how you think 10 steps ahead about where the punchline's coming and where the payoff is. And I just love that kind of linguistic play. I think stand-up is the hardest thing. Genuinely.
It's much harder than running away from a crocodile.
Much harder.
Running in a straight line.
Much harder than anyone. On a genuine level, I really do think it's. I'm watching my daughter kind of try and get the building blocks off it.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud. I'm really proud that that's what she wants to do with her skills, with her confidence, with her energy. I just happen to channel it in a slightly different way.
But if you hadn't had that call from the BBC and do you think you would have just been completely like in academia?
I really do. I kind of had already accepted that I probably wasn't. I chose. So we got a con when I was in my band. For the first 2 years at Oxford, I was travelling up and down into London, doing gigs in Camden, going back, getting back at 4 a.m, getting up to go to a lecture, trying to submit an essay. And it was really hard keeping the two worlds together.
Mm.
And then we got offered a contract and it was with a tour. And I remember saying, you know, I can't go. I'm doing my degree. I'm about to finish my degree. I've got to stick with it. And they said, well, you'll have to choose. You choose the band or you choose your Oxford degree. And I chose my Oxford degree. And they were livid and furious, rightly so. And they didn't speak to me for years. We're now back being best buds again. But I chose to be that nerd. Yeah. I invested in my nerdness. I would have just carried on loving kind of the weird side of being an academic and discovering things. But I think I'm too much of a... I love people and I love being around people. And I think academia can be incredibly closed and sort of insular. So thank God I got a chance to do different things.
I wouldn't like to pigeonhole all academics in a certain way, but you're not a typical academic.
Not standard.
Which is a good thing. But it's also good to be a typical academic as well.
Yeah, no insult meant to typical academics. You know.
Glad they're not
dusty,
on TV.
Dusty.
So what's coming? The books are coming out. One book's out. The Goddess book is out.
Yeah.
The feminine.
It's Latin for woman.
Feminax. Sanitary product. Femina, and it's out in July. Right?
Yeah.
Because it said right near my birthday. Said March one time, but it's
yeah. No, I know it changed. Went back because of kind of making it all work out with the two.
Nosy Crow. are the publishers of The Goddess Book, who also publish Catherine Wilkins' books, which you should also buy. That's my wife.
Oh, we're fellows, are we?
Yeah, they're excellent publishers. I love Nosy Crow. They are extremely good.
Oh, we have to do book exchange.
You should. Yes, we will. We will. And you've been in Egypt, so I guess that, yes. What's that show? Is that coming up soon? Well, or can you talk about it?
This is a big reveal, really.
Okay.
Okay, I will say.
Okay.
But I shouldn't.
Okay. good.
We've got 3 weeks, haven't we?
Yeah, well, apart from the live feed going out directly into...
Yeah, all right, I'll say it.
Okay.
So, yeah, I can say it. I finished
these
it
people won't. Yeah, no, there are
fine.
People here
it's
as
fine.
Well.
I finished, literally on Friday, yeah. So I can say. So I can say it. We have filmed the BBC's centenary special for the discovery by Howard Carter of Tutankhamun.
Amazing.
And had the most extraordinary experience. And, I've been saying about all these things that have happened to me. Nothing compares to what I've just been through in the last couple of weeks. I have cried a lot. I have pinched myself numerous times till I'm black and blue that I'm having this experience. And I can't tell you what happens at the end, but there is a huge reveal. And
they find Tutankhamun's tomb. That's what happens.
They do.
They find it in the end.
100 years ago.
That's the problem with history. You can just look it up in a book.
No, there's something really cool that happens on camera that we weren't expecting, and it's like, But
the mummy comes to life and kills 10 people.
Pretty much. It's close.
Okay, I'm very excited. Well, so did you get to touch all that stuff as well? Did you get to handle all that?
Sorry, my friend, yeah.
Did you get to handle Tutankhamun's pencil case? That's my favourite bit.
No, I'm not going to say.
Okay.
But yeah, lots of exciting things happened.
That's great.
But more than anything, it was... we've been working on this series for like a few years now, and it is a different way of doing these stories, because you're telling the story of the ancient Egyptians, you're telling the story of Howard Carter 100 years ago, and then you're telling the story of Egypt now and Egyptian archaeology now, and all the three threads sort of weave together. And it was just, for me, it just felt like a really high point in my life that I can tell these stories and you know, give voices to, you know, people who haven't had them before. It was nice.
Good.
And
well,
I got to go to Egypt in winter.
Yeah.
Although I did get a chest infection from Cairo.
Okay. Curse of Tutankhamun.
Maybe. Honestly, the team said that to me. They're like, you're ill, you've got about 3 days.
Yeah. it's getting a bit faint now, the curse I'll be giving a slight cold. What about COVID? No, just
no,
cold.
I know. PCR test. No, it's the curse. It says negative, positive, Curse of Tutankhamun.
Well, I can't wait. If the shows are on the iPlayer, look them up. They'll probably find them on YouTube or something. If not, and do buy the fantastic books as well. Please give a massive round of applause to Dr. Nina Ramirez. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week with Charlie Borman, Terry Christian. Come and see it. It's going to be good.
Terry Christian?
Yeah.
Oh. Thanks, everyone.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Yanina Ramirez. Thank you very much to Scant Regard. They're playing this music you're listening to right now. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm also indebted to Chris Evans. Not that one. Come on, it wouldn't be that one, would it? Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for fantastically hosting me once again. Thank you to all the crew and the team. Even George, the incompetent sound man. Let's thank everybody. Also, I am indebted to the Kickstarter campaign backers, including Mr. George Goodfellow, Gray Egerton, James Shade, Schroeder Luke, Steve Einett, Eric Fell, Dan Welton, Laura and Shane, Jai, Chris Kozak, Alan Buckman, Gideon Seymour, Carolyn Cooper, Nick Mankatolo, yeah, it could be, Mike Pass, Tim Nunney, Shirley Graham, Listener 997, David Williams, that's David Williams' real name, I hope it was him, Chris Phillips, Michael Hudson, Hannah James, Kevin Simmons, Rick Harrison, no name, Robbie Hand, Andrew Smalley, Jules Willis, Sean, Rod Begbie, Stuart Reed, Neil Curry, New Zealand's team of 5 million, Jason Cook, Marius Espenes. I feel that Chris Evans puts a couple of joke ones in there. Just to get me. Come on, Marius Espenes isn't real. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to richardherring.com/gigs to see who else is going to be on
this wonderful season at the Leicester Square Theatre. Tickets available for almost all gigs. Please come down and see it. Or you can watch the live stream, gfsboxoffice.com. And you can see us live streamed or watch the videos anytime you like after the show has been recorded. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'm going now. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.